Hello, I'm your reader, Bob Young, and it's time for our birthdays. We have three birthdays today. Frida Hyatt Cooper of Mitchellville. Happy birthday, Frida. Elma Sparks of Spring Hill. Happy birthday, Elma. And Robert Wolfe of Ankeny. Happy birthday, Robert. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your name on our birthday list. We can be reached at 515-243-6833, or you can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Now let's get back to the news with our first story from the USA Today. Mass vaccination sites soon arriving. FEMA may set up 100 high-volume clinics across USA. San Francisco. Jim Stevens got the text at 8 p.m. and was so excited he couldn't sleep. He had an appointment the next morning to get a COVID-19 vaccine at the city's first mass vaccination clinic. The 76-year-old drove up after it opened at 8 a.m. and was waved into a line of cars flowing slowly but steadily through a temporary chain-link fence. He drove along a line of volunteers, making choreographed stops. First, his appointment paperwork was checked. At the next checkpoint, he was given a surgical mask. A few feet further, a volunteer went over possible side effects. Finally, he rolled up to the table, where a nurse stood ready to give him his shot. Quote, "Frankly, I was nervous that they would run out," Stevens said from the seat of his car before the injection. Still clutching his appointment notification, he looked around, a huge grin on his face. Quote, "This is fantastic. Now I feel wonderful," unquote. As part of President Joe Biden's COVID-19 strategy, such mass vaccination clinics will soon become familiar to millions of Americans. The Federal Emergency Management Agency could run up to 100 high-volume sites nationwide within a month to help reach the administration's goal of giving 1.5 million shots a day during Biden's first 100 days in office. Though public health experts stress smaller pop-up sites must be employed to reach communities with access issues and vaccine hesitancy, large centralized hubs will play a key role. Quote, "These kinds of mass vaccination sites will be a significant and maybe even a major part of vaccination everywhere," said Dr. Joshua Adler, chief clinical officer for UCSF Health, which sponsors the site. Communities are largely coming up with their own mass vaccination plans. Plus, sometimes they are based on coronavirus testing sites, but they don't have to reinvent the wheel for COVID-19. High-volume clinics can be based on templates for influenza vaccinations developed and refined by public health and medical experts since at least 2005, said Dr. Kelly Moore, deputy director of the nonprofit Immunization Action Coalition. "States have drilled on these types of clinics for years," Moore said, "and her organization collects resources for conducting such clinics and posts them on a central website. Things don't always start smoothly. Last weekend, in Delaware, nightmarish lines at two mass sites on Saturday gave way to a more orderly system by Sunday, and 11,154 seniors and healthcare personnel got vaccinated. Extreme cold caused department health computer batteries to run down, leading to registration issues, which were resolved with generators. In New York's Broome County, mass vaccination appointments had to be voided because a website scheduled them prematurely. Even with a roadmap, a multitude of details must be worked out to run such a campaign. The complexity was on display in San Francisco, where the first mass vaccination site opened on January 22nd. As of Tuesday, about 2,500 people had received their first COVID-19 shot. Officials plan to have a total of three sites in three corners of the city to make them accessible to most residents. The first, near the city's southern edge, is in a parking lot slated to become public housing. quote, it's complicated, it's challenging, but we want to get a vaccine out the door and into the arms as fast as we possibly can, Mayor London Breed said at a news conference on Monday. Adler described the setup as a soft launch with limited hours to work out kinks before the site ramps up to a full capacity. A winter storm shut it down Wednesday, but the city hopes to have it up and running again on Friday. The speed at which everything came together was a welcome surprise. Quote, when I was told this site was going up in a few days, I said, can you really do that? Said Dr. Grant Colfax, director of the city's Department of Public Health. Quote, I owe a few people bottles of champagne now, unquote. The rate-limiting factor for San Francisco and many other locations is doses. Quote, this is not a people problem, this is a vaccine problem, Adler said. The city could offer at least 10,000 doses a day if it had them. Quote, that's why we need massive supplies of vaccine, Colfax said. To get an appointment, people must be older than 75 and receive their medical care at UCSF Medical Center, which provided vaccine and volunteers to staff the clinic. As more doses become available, that will expand to include patients from other medical systems and those in the public health system. Some people over 70 have gotten vaccine when there were extra appointments. The city offers only as many appointments in a day as it has doses, so many patients don't learn if they are among the lucky ones until the night before. Quote, the text came through on our 37th wedding anniversary, said Ralph Keeney, 77. Quote, we figured this was the best present we could have, unquote. The drill is simple, but staff intensive. On the first weekend, traffic officials and large lighted signs directed people to circle around the back of an enormous fenced parking lot next to a former concrete reservoir. At the entrance, after people got a fresh surgical mask and had their paperwork checked, brightly colored post-it notes were slapped on their windshields, one for each person getting vaccinated. The post-it notes were a brainstorm by nurse Heather Taylor. She was given shots and needed to quickly see how many people were waiting in line so she could be prepared with syringes. The handy, colorful stick-it notes did the trick. By Sunday afternoon, the practice had spread throughout the vaccination clinic. Cars lined up in all eight lanes at the main entrance sported bright, fluttering squares on their windshields. Such on-the-ground tweaks are an example of the developing system. Though there are playbooks for mass flu vaccination, COVID-19 comes with special requirements. Everyone must be spaced 6 feet apart, and those getting shots must be kept and observed for 15 minutes in case of adverse reactions. Quote, we started from scratch, said Martha Cohen, the mayor's director of special events. Cohen usually plans for big events such as parades, when the San Francisco Giants win the World Series, or, more recently, outdoor voting in front of City Hall. Quote, this is an event. It's like doing a show, only it's a really important one, she said. If not for COVID-19 restrictions, the site could fit 50 of the rented plastic tents the nurses worked under. But factoring in social distance, they could have only 28. To protect the vaccinators from traffic, the city rented bright orange water-filled jersey barriers and arranged them in a U-shape in front of their work areas. At the vaccination tables, the nurses wasted no time. Quote, we're aiming for just 10 minutes from the entrance to the shot and then a 15-minute observation period, Adler said. Inya Kim, 77, came prepared after she and her husband saw on the news that people waited in line for 5 hours at a mass vaccination clinic at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles, but she never had time to eat her stash of Kind bars, biscotti, and granola bars, or break into her thermos of hot tea. Quote, this is great. It only took 25 minutes, she said. I guess we'll have to eat all this at home. The system for syringe delivery was low-tech but effective. A temporary pharmacy was set up in a San Francisco City College building adjacent to the parking lot. Pharmacists took 10-dose Moderna vials out of refrigeration and drew down the vaccine into syringes. The syringes were kept in a refrigerator and taken out 4 at a time, so none was unrefrigerated for more than the 60 allowed minutes. Runners put them into red plastic containers and carried them out into the front of the building, where staff members in an electric golf cart waited. Another clinic worked up and down the vaccine tents, checking to make sure each had enough vaccine. When more was needed, the worker held up a small green flag and waved it. That signaled the people in the golf cart to zip over with newly filled syringes and take away the used ones. "It's working pretty well," Taylor said as she readied two shots for a couple pulling in next to her tent. Its table covered with hand sanitizer, alcohol wipes, gloves, and a stack of clipboards and forms. Once vaccinated, people drove into a large parking area where San Francisco traffic control officers waved them into parking spots. Doctors and nurses walked around the cars, checking for adverse reactions. Quote, "We're telling people to honk their horns or flash their lights if they're experiencing any difficulties," Adler said. "So far, we've had very few." After 15 minutes, a final duo of traffic officers guided the vaccinated out through the front entrance and happily on with their lives. John Paul Kruger Hansen was one of them. The 77-year-old was so excited to get the vaccine, he brought the International Immunization Certificate he got decades ago when he immigrated to the USA from Denmark. Quote, "I was hoping they'd fill it in, COVID next to smallpox," he said, showing off the fading yellow booklet. "This will totally change my level of happiness," unquote. His wife, Debbie, too young for the shot, spent the visit taking photos and video of the whole process. Quote, "We texted it to our daughter. We texted it to everyone," Kruger Hansen said. "The next thing is to get Debbie vaccinated, and then we can start to get back to normal." So far, so good. Few serious health issues from shots. Story filed by Karen Winthrop of the USA Today. Early safety data from the first month of COVID-19 vaccination finds the shots are as safe as the studies suggested. Everyone who experienced an allergic response has been treated successfully, and no other serious problems have turned up among the first 22 million people vaccinated, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The data were collected from several tracking systems, including a voluntary one in which people who are vaccinated report their symptoms via text. Another allows people who believe they have been harmed by a vaccine to contribute their information. And a third collects reports from medical records. Although it's never possible to prove something is completely safe, data from these tracking systems suggest the vaccines are not causing large numbers of unusual or dangerous results. Wednesday, Dr. Tom Shimabukuro, Deputy Director of the CDC's Immunization Safety Office, briefed the CDC Advisory Committee on the agency's review of safety data collected on the two authorized vaccines. Side effects remain a common result of both the Pfizer-BioNTech and the Moderna vaccines. 70% of people who self-reported said they suffered pain. Vaccinated people have suffered health crises and even death within a few days of receiving a shot. But the rate of those events is no higher than would be expected in the general population and cannot be connected to the vaccine, the review found. Shimabukuro did not address reports that several people died after receiving a vaccine, including a Florida doctor and a California X-ray technologist. More than 2 million people out of the first 22 million to receive at least one dose of vaccine reported to the VSafe, a self-reporting system involving web surveys and text messages. Of those, more than 70% reported pain, 33% fatigue, 30% headaches, 23% muscle pain, and about 11% chills, fever, swelling, or joint pain. There was little difference in the reported side effects between the two vaccines, though people generally had a harder time with the second dose than the first. More than 9,000 people reported side effects after vaccination to the CDC's Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS. The problems in slightly more than 1,000 of those reports were considered serious. The majority of complaints involved headaches, fatigue, dizziness, nausea, chills, fever, and pain. A third safety reporting system, called the Vaccine Safety Data Link, looks at medical records from 9 participating healthcare organizations, including data on more than 12 million people per year. More than 162,000 people in the system have received at least one COVID-19 shot. In that group, there were no signals as of January 16 of increased risk for any of the 20 common conditions, which included heart attack, appendicitis, embolisms, and disease caused by low platelet counts. In the vaccinated group, 4 people reported Bell's palsy, a form of facial paralysis seen in a small number of people in each of the vaccine trials. In the unvaccinated group, there were 348 cases. One way to figure out whether COVID-19 vaccines kill people is to look at the number of people expected to die over a period of time and compare that with deaths that occurred within a few days of vaccination. Veyers received reports of 196 deaths after COVID-19 vaccination. Of those, 66% were residents of long-term care facilities. About 1.3 million nursing home residents were vaccinated from December 21st to January 18th. In a group that large followed over that length of time, 11,440 people would be expected to die of all causes. That led the CDC to conclude the much lower number of nursing home deaths were not caused by vaccination. Barbara Bardenhauer of the Brown University School of Public Health conducted a related study of residents at Genesis Healthcare, the largest nursing home company in the USA. More than 7,000 Genesis residents in 118 facilities received their first vaccine dose from December 18th through the 31st. After excluding people with active COVID-19 infection, the researchers found fewer deaths among the vaccinated residents compared with unvaccinated ones. Quote, findings suggest that short-term mortality rates appear unrelated to vaccination for COVID-19 in skilled nursing facility residents, according to a summary of the study's results. The CDC found no causal link between vaccination and deaths among younger, healthier people. Among 13.7 million people under 65, 168 people would be expected to suffer a sudden lethal heart attack over a typical 35-day period. By comparison, 18 such deaths were reported to VAERS among people who were vaccinated. Both vaccines have been shown to trigger a relatively high, though still rare, rate of severe allergic reactions. Among 10 million people who received the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, 50 went into anaphylactic shock, a rate of 5 serious allergic reactions per 1 million doses. 21 people out of 7.6 million who received the Moderna vaccine went into shock, a rate of 2.8 per 1 million doses. 90% of those incidents occurred within a half hour of getting a shot, and all recovered. By comparison, for the seasonal flu shot, the rate of anaphylaxis is 1.3 per million shots. Still, quote, the risks of getting sick from COVID-19 are much higher than the risks of anaphylaxis, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky said Wednesday. The CDC is investigating whether people who had COVID-19 before getting the shot were more likely to have an adverse allergic reaction. Biden ends abortion funds rule. Story filed by Maureen Grope, Washington, allowing federal funds to flow again to international groups that provide or refer patients for abortion services is the easy part of President Joe Biden's promise to reverse Trump administration policies on reproductive health issues. Biden did that with a stroke of the pen on Thursday. Undoing restrictions on U.S. clinics that provide abortion counseling or services will take more time, as would changing when employers can decline to include birth control in workers' health care plans. Passing legislation to codify the right to an abortion and allowing low-income women to get government-funded abortions, which Biden backed during his presidential campaign, face roadblocks in a closely divided Congress. Biden's promise to appoint federal judges who support the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision establishing abortion rights is a long-term effort that may not be as successful as President Donald Trump's judicial accomplishments. Advocates are eager for action, particularly after women played a crucial role in Biden's victory. If only men had voted, Trump would have won. Quote, "We really are pushing this administration not just to undo the harm of the Trump administration, but to move us forward in really important ways," said Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center. Biden frames his views in the context of one of his top priorities, creating a more equitable society for people of color and other marginalized groups. Quote, "We are deeply committed to making sure everyone has access to care, including reproductive health care, regardless of income, race, zip code, health insurance status, or immigration status," Biden said in a joint statement with Vice President Kamala Harris regarding the 48th anniversary of Roe v. Wade last week. Quote, "When we look at the communities that are most affected by restrictive reproductive policy, you're talking about the most marginalized community," said Amanda Roberti, a political science professor at San Francisco State University who studies reproductive justice issues. Anthony Fauci, Biden's top medical advisor, told the World Health Organization last week that the United States would revoke the Mexico City policy, which blocked funding to groups that include abortion services or information in their family planning programs, as part of a broader commitment to protect women's health and advanced general equality at home and around the world. Trump restored and expanded the Mexico City policy, which was started by the Reagan administration and has been turned off and on again during, depending on whether a Democrat or Republican held the White House. In addition to signing an order rescinding that policy Thursday, Biden began undoing a similar restriction on domestic groups. Trump effectively blocked clinics from receiving federal family planning grants through the Title X if they offered abortion services with other funds. Trump changed the rules on counseling, barring referrals for abortion services. Since those changes, about one quarter of clinics and other providers that have received federal grants to help the uninsured or low-income patients no longer participate, according to the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation. Six states withdrew entirely from the Title X network: Hawaii, Maine, Oregon, Utah, Vermont, and Washington. Most of the Title X clinics in seven other states, Alaska, Connecticut, Illinois, Maryland, Minnesota, New York, and New Hampshire, left the program. The number of clinics served by the program dropped by about 840,000, or 21%. Clinics didn't close because they had other funding sources, but services were curtailed, said Alina Selganikoff, director of women's health policy for the Kaiser Family Foundation. Quote, "Hours are often restricted so that it is much harder to get an appointment," she said. "The waits are longer." Restoring the funding will require a months-long rules writing process. Quote, "This will likely be step one on a long road to rebuild the provider network," said Audrey Sandusky, a spokeswoman for the National Family Planning and Reproductive Health Association. Biden will need to use the regulatory process to simplify payment for abortion coverage that is part of health plans under the Affordable Care Act, and to make it harder for employers to opt out of including contraceptive services in their health care plans for workers. Without insurance, women can expect to pay $600 to $1,000 annually for oral contraception and more for longer-acting methods such as IUDs. Trump allowed any employer with religious objections, and many with moral concerns, to bypass the ACA's requirement that insurance plans include birth control coverage. There were legal challenges to the ACA's workaround for religious organizations. The Supreme Court ruled in July that religious nonprofit groups, such as the Little Sisters of the Poor, can keep contraceptive coverage off their plans instead of having insurers offer it directly to their employees. Biden called that ruling a disappointment and promised to restore the Obama-Biden policy that existed before the court challenges. He withdrew his support for the Hyde Amendment, which blocks federal funding for abortion in most cases. He backed codifying the right to an abortion as a backup in case the Supreme Court overturns or eviscerates Roe v. Wade. Anti-abortion groups, which lauded Trump as the most pro-life president in the nation's history, have started to fight back. Quote, "Now is no time to give in, not when we're this close," Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, wrote in a Fox News opinion piece last week. Though Democrats control both chambers of Congress, they have the narrowest of majorities in the Senate and don't have enough votes to overcome a filibuster. The Susan B. Anthony group spent $200,000 on radio ads pressuring West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, one of the few anti-abortion Democrats in Congress, to continue supporting the Hyde Amendment and opposing eliminating the filibuster. Quote, "The Senate filibuster is the only thing standing between us and the pro-abortion agenda of the Washington liberals," unquote, an announcer says in the ads. Thankfully, Senator Joe Manchin is standing strong for life, unquote. Borchelt said reproductive rights advocates have to be realistic about the numbers that we have in Congress, unquote. But lawmakers can lay the groundwork for changes by introducing legislation and holding hearings. Quote, "It's certainly true that we're facing a federal judiciary that Trump was able to transform," Borchelt said, "and that damage is going to be long-lasting." Kenosha cops at Blake scene returned to full duty, filed by Elliot Hughes, Milwaukee. Two Kenosha, Wisconsin police officers who were present during the shooting of Jacob Blake but did not use deadly force against him have returned to full duty as of January 20th, Chief Daniel Miskinis announced. Officers Vincent Arenas and Brittany Maronek have been on administrative leave since August 23rd, the day of the shooting that left Blake paralyzed. The two were cleared of wrongdoing by Noble Ray, a former Madison police chief hired as an outside consultant to review the State Department of Justice's investigation into the shooting. Officer Rustin Chesky, who shot at Blake's back 7 times at point-blank range as he tried climbing into a car with his children inside, remains on administrative leave pending a routine internal review of his use of deadly force. Kenosha County District Attorney Michael Gravely also declined to change Shelsky in the shooting, saying Shelsky could successfully argue self-defense since Blake had a knife. A video of the shooting, which was widely shared on social media, sparked protests, vandalism, and arson in Kenosha. Blake's shooting and its aftermath propelled Wisconsin into the national spotlight. Both Donald Trump and President-elect Joe Biden discussed it during campaign stops in the state. Biden met with Blake's family and said charges against Shelsky appeared warranted, while Trump defended police. On August 25th, the third night of protests in Kenosha, two men, Anthony Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum, were fatally shot by a teenager armed with an AR-15-style rifle. Kyle Rittenhouse, then 17, has been charged with killing them and with wounding Gage Cross-Crutes. Now let's turn to the opinion section from the Des Moines Register. Iowa Ag bounces back, needs Biden to be prudent. Recently released data demonstrates Iowa agricultural trade is bouncing back. After years of tough negotiating, and even amid the unforeseeable impacts of COVID-19, global markets are recovering and more Iowa products are moving from our farms to tables around the world. New markets are embracing Iowa products at record levels. In the first 3 quarters of 2020 alone, Iowa food and agriculture exports grew by 4.3% in overseas markets, driven by increased demand for Iowa corn, meat, and soybeans. For example, Iowa exports to China surged to $1.08 billion, a 41% year-over-year increase. Japan boosted Iowa agricultural purchases to $935 million in the same time frame. Iowa farmers have managed to overcome challenge after challenge before demand rebounded. While these recent trade successes are encouraging, more must be done to level the playing field for Iowa farmers and allow Iowa agriculture to expand into new markets. This includes maintaining a reasonable regulatory environment, implementing a pro-growth tax policies, and investing in critical infrastructure projects. The Biden administration should seek input from farmers across the heartland, the farmers who have worked around the clock to feed and fuel Americans and the world during the COVID-19 pandemic, as they lay out new policy plans. Modern waterway infrastructure helps Iowa farmers efficiently send products to ports for shipment around the world. Unfortunately, much of the river infrastructure along the Mississippi has been neglected and desperately needs an upgrade. Without these investments, foreign competitors like Brazil will be able to further encroach on Iowa's export market share. There are multiple projects across Iowa that are primed for federal investment, including Dubuque's Lock and Dam No. 11, that will ensure Iowa farmers have reliable access to export options. If the Biden administration turns back the clock to a culture of regulation over innovation and implements crippling taxes, the agriculture community will take a hit. Farmers across Iowa are rightly concerned about the impact higher taxes, more regulation, and inconsistent trade policy will have on their livelihoods, not to mention on their ability to maintain the nation's secure food supply. Farmer-friendly economic policy must remain a priority. When it comes to the environment, Iowans know that agriculture has been and will continue to be a leading solution in driving down emissions and improving land stewardship. Through historic conservation efforts, Iowa farms are sequestering carbon, improving soil health, and moving forward with a culture of conservation that leaders of all parties can support. Iowa's farming community works day in and day out to put food on kitchen tables in the United States and around the world. In 2020, it became clear that Iowa agriculture is more resilient than ever imagined, as Iowa farmers stepped up to maintain a safe and reliable food supply chain amid the unprecedented challenges presented by COVID-19 pandemic. This grit, combined with prudent policy and aggressive partnerships at the federal level, will continue to ensure our food and agriculture community is well positioned to capitalize on new market opportunities and remain a strong player on the world stage. Here are the letters to the editor. Tax cuts now will hurt us in the long run. Governor Kim Reynolds is again leading our one-party legislature to more tax cuts. Let us pause and be Iowa honest enough to admit that tax cuts are synonymous with defunding our government services. More tax cuts mean more defunding of our already diminished law enforcement by peace officers in our state parks, more diminished law enforcement by inspectors in our nursing homes, and further defunding of our once nation-best public schools. Tax cuts defund and dismantle our government, which protects the safety and reliability of our peaceful enjoyment of state parks, the quality of the gas we pump for our cars, and the light by which you read this letter. Be Iowa honest about tax cuts before you wake up as we did a few years ago when we discovered tax cuts left us with just a handful of Iowa state troopers to patrol the entire state each night. Signed by Michael May of Indianola. Members of Congress should have term limits. When the companies that benefit the most withdraw their funding for our political system, saying the system is not working, then it is clearly not working. So what do we do? It's time to start a discussion on how to form a more perfect union. Some members of Congress voted to contest the votes of the Electoral College, not because they thought they were improper, but because they were afraid of losing their seat. In my mind, this means it's time to start the discussion about term limits, freeing members of Congress to do what we elected them to do, run the country, not vote in accordance with their party boss. It is time now to amend the Constitution to limit terms of members of Congress. This is a long process, so we need to start now. signed by John Walsing of Belmond. Problematic ideas at the State House. The education savings account system currently under debate in Iowa dismantles and partially privatizes public education. Every strong democracy in the world has a unified public education system with robust financial and moral support, guaranteeing each generation learns facts and beliefs necessary to continue democracy. Voucher systems fracture public school funding, dispersing money to private schools with different oversight and accountability. Consider another proposal called the, quote, Back to the Blue Act, unquote. It aims to punish riots against police. The key word is riots. Who decides it's a riot or a protest? This act is an assault on democratic rule, which should welcome protests, the voice of citizens. If this becomes law, it will cut state money to any city attempting to defund the police. Quote, defund is a term promoted by activist groups, and it means to reimagine and reallocate money. For example, redirect some money to more appropriate areas like mental health and family crisis centers. This would relieve police of responsibilities better suited to other professionals. Up to 60% of the budget in Des Moines and other cities goes to public safety, a huge amount that deserves reexamination. These two pieces of legislation don't get media attention like insurrections and voter suppression, but they are real threats to democracy. It's clear that many Republican lawmakers are choosing political power over democracy. Signed by Betty Salmon of Urbandale. That was the end of the letters to the editor, and now we'll continue with more opinion pieces. A famine of political courage damages our nation. Our state and country suffer from a famine of political courage, and unfortunately, it is nothing new. Our elected officials have demonstrated the lack of courage to do the right thing because of a fear of personal consequences, criticism, and party pressures. Politicians voting as the party demands instead of as their conscience dictates has become the norm. It seems to this no-party voter that much too often elected officials kowtow to their own party line and to powerful constituents, despite the need for nonpartisan behavior and conscientious thought. This occurs on both sides of the aisle and is commonly accepted as good governance. Is it really the way it has to be? Why do we accept this when we go to the ballot box? Whatever happened to independent thought and having the courage to make difficult decisions by those we elect, even at their own political peril? We can and must demand this in our elected leaders, and voters should hold politicians accountable for their past decisions at re-election time. In 1955, Senator John F. Kennedy explained in his book, Profiles in Courage, that true democracy puts faith in people who elect others to not only represent their views ably and faithfully, but also have them exercise their own conscientious judgment. Courage, therefore, should be rewarded and honor respected. Democracy requires more than popular government and majority rule. Kennedy wrote that each elected official has a choice to make during a crisis of national unity. Courage or compliance. You may not agree with his politics, but it's hard to disagree with this simple truth. This famine of political courage has become increasingly apparent during the past year, as demonstrated with issues surrounding the pandemic, the election, and the insurrection at our nation's capital, to name a few. When the safety and security of our country is at stake, courage from our elected leaders is of paramount importance. Unfortunately, in today's political climate, most politicians retreat to compliance within the party line and are often silent rather than rebuking the party rhetoric. Silence is the antithesis of courage. Preserving democratic principles requires a willingness to defend those principles and to make sacrifices on their behalf. Abraham Lincoln said it well, quote, "Let us have faith that the right makes right, and in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it," unquote. The plea to local and national elected officials is simple. During seminal moments that summon independent thought and courageous action, regardless of the personal consequences that may follow, vote your conscience, not your party or ideology. It may not guarantee you get reelected, but then again, you might just find voters appreciate your honesty and reward your demonstrated courage with their vote. Remember, you represent all Iowans and Americans, not just those in your party. Leadership that demonstrates courage and honor should not be an exception, but the bare minimum that voters should demand from those elected, regardless of political party. Constitutional duty requires courage, not conformity. Signed by David P. Lind of West Des Moines. Let's turn back to the USA Today section. USA Today will aggressively cover Biden, and this is filed under the backstory. In his first week, President Joe Biden signed more than 30 executive orders overturning Donald Trump's policies and ramping up the country's COVID-19 response. As he rolls out his team and priorities, here's how USA Today will cover him aggressively. We've got a team of 7 reporters assigned to the Biden-Harris administration, each with areas of expertise. Michael Collins will focus on the economy. Courtney Subramanian will watchdog the COVID-19 response. Rebecca Morin will follow immigration policy. Joey Garrison will examine how the administration interacts with state and local governments. Maureen Grope will focus on health care. Deborah Barry will write on racial equality. And Matthew Brown will bulldog breaking news. What they all have in common is a desire to hold the powerful accountable and empower our readers with the news and information they need to better their lives and their communities. Quote, I want to tell Americans how the decisions that are being made in Washington are directly impacting our lives, Collins said. The COVID-19 pandemic has been devastating for many American families, yet others are doing well in spite of this public health crisis. That just underscores what the experts have been telling us for a long time about the wealth disparity in this country. That means getting beyond what we're hearing from administration and talking to people who are struggling, unquote. Morin will be tracking Biden on his promise of getting comprehensive immigration reform passed. And accountability can't happen if I don't know what concerns real-life people have, unquote. She'll also report on how Biden policies impact immigrant communities. Most urgent of Biden's promises is leading us out of the pandemic. Almost half of his orders so far have focused on this, ramping up vaccine distribution and public health supplies, expanding testing, and safely reopening schools. Quote, the president himself has pointed out the death toll could top 500,000 by the end of next month, Subramanian said. It's a challenge that's illuminated federal bureaucratic failures, logistical challenges, and coordinating a national response and years of a largely underfunded and understaffed public health system. Quote, the tensions between the Biden administration's ambitious plan and the grim reality of the pandemic is colliding at a time when urgency is critical. The pandemic response is a daunting task, but one that will define Biden's legacy and determine whether he'll be able to achieve other aspects of his agenda. Gropey said Biden has promised to be fully transparent about his team's success and failure. Quote, it's up to the media to hold him to that, she said. We'll be watching to gauge what he accomplishes and whether more could be done to not just return to normalcy, but to build back better, as he pledged. Gropey has spent the past 4 years covering Vice President Mike Pence and Second Lady Karen Pence, so she's eager to see how Vice President Kamala Harris and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff approach their positions. Quote, Harris, of course, is the first woman and the first woman of color to be vice president. Biden, who presented himself during the campaign as a bridge to the next generation of leaders, appears to be more comfortable sharing the spotlight with her than Trump was with Pence, she said. Quote, but she still has a tricky position to manage as both a supporting character and as someone who wants to become the first female president. Garrison will be reporting on the challenges city and state governments face navigating tough budgets due to the pandemic, and their uphill work to vaccinate their citizens. Quote, Biden is pushing a national strategy to fight the COVID-19 pandemic, a departure from Trump, who largely left the responsibility of vaccination plans and purchasing medical equipment up to the states, Garrison said. Quote, will governors and mayors see those changes at the government level? My reporting will answer that question. Barry will cover voting rights, civil rights, disparities, and inequality. Quote, Biden and Harris campaigned on those issues, and many civil rights leaders and voting rights advocates said they are going to hold them accountable, unquote, she said. Most of this isn't new, so I hope to team up with my colleagues to keep an eye on their proposals and policies and let readers know if they are working, unquote. And let's talk about the question we get most often. Will we cover Biden and Harris as aggressively as we did Trump and Pence? Absolutely. Quote, I approached this assignment the same way I did when Donald Trump was in office, to ferret out the truth, Collins said. Quote, that means asking hard questions, demanding answers, and digging deeper. Joe Biden doesn't hold the kind of contempt for the free press that Trump did. But as reporters, we can't let the fact that there's a friendlier face in the White House keep us from holding the new administration accountable, unquote. Subramanian says she's hoping for less whiplash than during the Trump years and spending more time on how Biden will reshape the government. Quote, the Biden administration came to power on the promise of healing a nation in mourning, she said, holding them to their promises, explaining the implications of their policies, and telling the stories of those whose policies affect will be critical to covering this White House. Brown said he expects the Biden administration to run a much tighter ship than the Trump White House when it comes to leaks, referring to the palace intrigue often served up to reporters during the Trump era. Brown said he's expecting more difficulty sourcing up in a White House where everyone is not trying to knife fight each other, unquote. He said he thinks there will be more of a unified front in the Biden White House, and that will present its own challenges. Our White House reporters aren't the only ones covering the big issues. They will link up with teams assigned to the Congress and key government departments, as well as with USA Today journalists and local reporters in 260-plus newsrooms nationwide who have expertise on issues such as extremism and misinformation, social justice, climate change, healthcare, and education. Karen Bohan is our Washington editor and deputy Washington bureau chief. She'll be overseeing this coverage. Her promise, quote, our role as journalists is to be watchdogs for government. That's true of how we cover the Biden administration, and it was true of how we covered Trump. Our audience expects nothing less, unquote. We ask you to hold us to this. Calls mount for Green's ouster. Lawmakers' posts on social media spur outcry, filed by Crystal Hayes of USA Today. Washington. Some House Democrats want Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to resign, be expelled from Congress, or stripped of her committee post after past remarks surfaced appearing to show the Georgia Republican endorsing violence against prominent Democrats on Facebook. Greene's controversial remarks trickled out during her successful campaign election in November, but over the past week, an array of new posts surfaced that left some Democrats condemning her and calling for her ouster. The outcry came after CNN published an in-depth look at Green's Facebook before she ran for office, finding she liked a comment in January 2019 that said Pelosi should be taken out with a, quote, bullet to the head, unquote. In a video around that time, Green said Pelosi was a traitor to our country. She's guilty of treason, saying it was a crime punishable by death. Representative Don Beyer, Democrat from Virginia, called for her resignation Tuesday, writing to Green on Twitter, quote, your conduct does not reflect credibility on the House, and you should resign. Representative Jimmy Gomez, a Democrat from California, introduced a resolution Wednesday calling for Green to be expelled. Quote, such advocacy for extremism and sedition not only demands her immediate expulsion from Congress, but it also merits strong and clear condemnation from all her Republican colleagues, Gomez said. Quote, her very presence in office represents a direct threat against the elected officials and staff who serve our government. Adding on to the controversy, Green was appointed Wednesday to the House Education and Labor Committee, a post that further angered Democrats due to her comments on school shootings. Video footage went viral this week, showing Green appearing to heckle a teen survivor of a deadly school shooting in Parkland, Florida. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi unloaded on Republicans for their handling of Green's conduct, saying her appointment to the panel was absolutely appalling, unquote. Quote, assigning her to the Education Committee when she has mocked the killing of little children, Pelosi said. What could they be thinking? Or is thinking too generous a word for what they might be doing, unquote. Republican Bobby Scott, the Virginia Democrat who chairs the House Education and Labor Committee, similarly did not mince words on Green's appointment. He said House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, needs to explain his rationale in appointing the Georgia Republican to the panel. Mark Bednar, a spokesman for McCarthy, told Axios that Green's comments were deeply disturbing and Leader McCarthy plans to have a conversation with the congresswoman about them, unquote. Green, who has been a congresswoman for about 3 weeks, has not apologized for the remarks, but in a statement on Twitter, she said others helped manage her account over the years. Quote, many posts have been liked, many posts have been shared, some did not represent my views, she wrote. She also called CNN's report fake news and insisted that the media was trying to cancel her over her views. Asked about the calls for her to be ousted from Congress and removed from the committee, Green's office said, quote, Congresswoman Green has zero plans to comply with Democrat demands of her, unquote. They are coming after me because they know I represent the people, not the politicians, Green said in a statement. Quote, they are coming after me because, like President Trump, I will always defend conservative values. They want to take me out because I represent the people, and they absolutely hate it, unquote. In a Facebook post from April 2018, Green responded to a post from a person who asked whether former President Barack Obama and former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton could be hanged, CNN reported. Green replied by saying, quote, the stage is being set. Players are being put in place. We must be patient. This must be done perfectly, or liberal judges would let them off, unquote, CNN reported. Green was controversial before joining Congress over her past remarks and support for the QAnon conspiracy fringe movement. She has routinely refused to wear face masks during the pandemic and has been one of the loudest peddlers of baseless theories of election fraud. Senators explore censuring Trump. With acquittal likely, Democrats mull options, filed by Bart Janssen of USA Today, Washington. After a vote Tuesday suggested the Senate may likely acquit former President Donald Trump at his impeachment trial, Democratic senators searched Wednesday for ways to make their case against him. Many Republicans and Democrats conceded a Trump conviction seemed unlikely given the vote, but Senate Democratic leaders doubled down on moving forward with the impeachment trial, while others suggested they try something else. One path for Democrats is to pursue the trial scheduled to resume February 9th, describing the violence that left 5 dead and playing videos of the Capitol under siege as a way to document Trump's role in the January 6th riot at the Capitol. Another option some senators are exploring is to censure Trump, a more modest step than conviction, aimed at gaining more bipartisan support. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, said he is exploring offering a resolution censoring Trump as a punishment that could attract more Republicans to climb on board than conviction and possible prohibition from future office. But Kaine said he wouldn't offer up his plan unless 10 Republicans joined. Quote, I've drafted something, Kaine said. I haven't filed it yet because I'm trying to get other people's ideas about what should be in it. But I'm hoping that we might find it, and it could be an alternative. His comments came after the Senate voted 55-45 Tuesday to reject a motion from Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, who challenged the impeachment trial as unconstitutional because Trump has already left office. Paul lost the vote, but it signaled Trump won't be convicted of inciting insurrection at the Capitol, which would require a two-thirds majority. Kane called the vote clarifying that there won't be 67 votes to convict Trump. Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat of West Virginia, said, "You pretty much know where it's going to go." When asked whether the same 45 Republicans would vote to acquit, Senator John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, said, quote, "That would be my guess, yeah." Paul called the trial dead on arrival. Despite the vote, Democrats are pressing forward. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin questioned whether the 45 Republicans who voted to avoid the trial agreed with Paul's argument, are still loyal to Trump, or fear his followers. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, insisted the trial would go forward. Quote, "The evidence against the former president will be presented in living color for the nation and every one of us to see," Schumer said. "Once again, no one will be able to avert their gaze from what Mr. Trump said and did and the consequences of his actions. We will all watch what happened. We will listen to what happened, and then we will vote," unquote. Durbin offered an overview of the House impeachment case against Trump from the Senate floor that was occupied 3 weeks earlier by a riotous mob. Quote, "How can anyone who was in this chamber January 6th really argue that something critical and important and horrific occurred?" Durbin asked. Quote, "It was his last desperate grasp to keep the White House, even at the expense of the Constitution and reality," unquote. And that's it for our second hour of The Register on IRIS. We're so glad you have been listening. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.